Today at Reader's Corner, Joseph McCartan, author of Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America.
Air traffic controllers worked in some of the most stressful conditions of any worker in the United States, especially in some of the high traffic facilities of the country. They were engaged in an illegal walkout. Federal workers did not have a right to strike. So there was really a heavy burden upon them to justify what they were trying to do. Teachers were the public sector workers most prone to striking in the 1970s. Once PATCO was broken, teacher strikes also began to become far less common after 1981.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's been called the strike that forever changed unions. On August 3, 1981, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, or PATCO, called an illegal strike to seek better working conditions, better pay, and a shorter work week. In turn, President Ronald Reagan, in office for less than 7 months, declared the PATCO strike a threat to national safety and ordered the air traffic controllers back to work. Only 10% complied of the nearly 13,000 workers PATCO represented. 2 days later, following the PATCO's workers' refusal to return to work, Reagan permanently fired the remaining 11,000 strikers. In his book, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers and the Strike That Changed America, Joseph A. McCartan writes that the PATCO strike was more than just a labor dispute about a single issue. It was the culmination of 20 years of conflict, reoccurring airline disasters, and the struggles of individual air traffic controllers to better their livelihoods. While Reagan was cast as a union buster, the truth is more nuanced, Dr. McCartan contends. Collision Course explores how PATCO's unyielding position forced Reagan's hardline stance and led to the union's demise. Dr. McCartan is a history professor at Georgetown University and an expert on 20th century U.S. labor, social, and political issues. He joins us today by phone from his offices at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Joseph A. McCartan, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's a great pleasure and honor to be with you.
Well, how bad were the working conditions of air traffic controllers on the eve of the 1981 strike?
Air traffic controllers worked in some of the most stressful conditions of any worker in the United States, especially in some of the high traffic facilities of the country, places like O'Hare Airport or the New York Air Traffic Control Center. They worked 40-hour work weeks, whereas most controllers in other advanced nations worked significantly less, averaging about 36 hours at that time. And they sometimes worked with equipment that they felt was not reliable. So those were some of the issues that motivated the controllers going into their negotiation with the Reagan administration in 1981. And what framed that negotiation too, Bob, as you point out in your introduction, was that there had been about 20 years of bad blood building between air traffic controllers and their employer, the Federal Aviation Administration, which they felt hadn't taken some of these concerns seriously to that point. And that helped set up the tragedy you've just outlined.
To what extent could the airline disasters of that time be traced back to these conditions? Were these airline disasters eventually pinned on pilot error? How many of them? I know there were some of them. I think it was the San Diego crash that clearly was tied to air traffic control issues.
Right. In 1978, there was a horrible mid-air collision in clear skies over San Diego, which had to do with some of the failures of the technology of the time. A malfunctioning warning system led controllers to believe that a problem wasn't there that was in fact developing that led to a collision. But I would say that over the 20 years preceding the 1981 event, controllers had consistently, complained about some of the problems that they were encountering. As I point out in the book, the seminal event that got air traffic controllers to organize in the first place was a terrible air tragedy that happened on December 16, 1960, over the skies of New York City when two planes collided, and one of them came down in the streets of Brooklyn, killing people on the ground as well. Altogether, that tragedy cost 134 lives. And for the air traffic controllers who were working in New York at that time, that event really galvanize them and convince them that they had to organize as a group to press for improvements in the conditions that they were working in. I also focus in the book on two individuals who were working that day. Their names were Mike Rock and Jack Maher. They were both deeply affected by that tragedy. They went on to be the founders of PATCO, and in fact, they were still involved with the organization 20 years later when it went on strike.
To some extent, when it comes to how much public support there seemed to be in 1981 for what President Reagan did, it seems to some extent be because PATCO really didn't do a very good marketing job here, did they? I mean, they didn't seem effective in convincing the American public that the strike was necessary not only for their own narrow and selfish reasons regarding salary, but better technology, as the San Diego crash demonstrated, and better working conditions.
Well, that's exactly right, Bob. I think what in retrospect, even PATCO people will say about that event is that they did a very poor job of explaining their issues to the public. And after all, they were engaged in an illegal walkout. Federal workers did not have a right to strike. So there was really a heavy burden upon them to justify what they were trying to do. Unfortunately for them, they did not think through how heavy that burden was and how necessary it would be to try to persuade the public that they had real grievances that needed to be addressed. Instead, they came to believe that there would be no way that the government could operate the air traffic control system if they walked out en masse, and that this would force the government to deal with them, even though the strike was illegal. As it turned out, though, once Ronald Reagan laid down that ultimatum in the first hours of the strike and gave them 48 hours to return to work, the vast majority of the public said, the president's doing the right thing. And at that moment, really, the window closed for air traffic controllers to try to explain their case. They still believed that the president wouldn't be able to follow through on this threat, but ultimately he did, and their union was broken with tremendous implications, not only for the controllers, but for the labor movement overall.
You take it back even before Reagan and maintain that Carter may have emboldened the air traffic controllers.
That's right. Now, one thing that some of your listeners who are old enough to recall might remember about the PATCO strike is that one of the ironies of the conflict between Reagan and the air traffic controllers was that PATCO actually endorsed Reagan's election in 1980. And the reason they did that is that 4 years of the Carter administration, they felt, convinced them that Jimmy Carter just did not get it regarding the concerns they had about their jobs, that the Carter administration was not going to negotiate with them on the issues that they felt were important when their contract expired in 1981. And they decided to take their chances with Reagan. And in fact, they negotiated with the Reagan campaign around that endorsement. And Reagan wrote a letter to the controllers and said, if I'm elected, I will take your grievances seriously. And so that convinced them to support Reagan. And ultimately, I would say that each side in that event kind of misread the other. PATCO felt like it was being promised more than it actually was being promised by the president. And on the Reagan side, the Reagan administration tried to negotiate with PATCO in 1981, and it felt that what it was offering was far more than what Carter had offered. In fact, Reagan and his team actually offered a salary increase to controllers, which was unprecedented at that time. Federal workers weren't supposed to be able to negotiate over their salaries. So the Reagan teams thought that PATCO would welcome that proposal, but it did not go nearly as far enough for the controllers to be satisfied with it. And so we had this tragic miscommunication that led to the conflict that I write about.
You're listening to Joseph A. McCartin, author of Collision Course. And of course, your subtitle is The Strike That Changed America in a number of respects, but certainly when you look at the dearth of strikes today, you can comment on how that strike may well have affected so much of what's happened in labor union history since then. And then also just this idea of Reagan being emboldened, the Republican Party being emboldened, and the conservatives strengthening themselves and moving into the era we find ourselves in today? Help us understand that.
Great questions. Let me take the first one first, and then I'll circle back to the second. The first regarding the strike and its role in American labor relations. I think you could say that since the early years of American industrialization, when workers first began to feel the need to organize into unions, their ability to withhold their labor in a strike was always a crucial element in negotiations. And over the course of the 20th century, once the Wagner Act was passed in the New Deal era, strikes had become sort of routinized. They'd become routine in American labor relations, in the private sector at least, where workers would withhold their labor at the end of a negotiation to try to get the best deal. Employers expected it, and both sides ultimately came to terms. The strike was then kind of a central last-ditch weapon for workers. In the United States, between the end of World War II and the end of the 1970s, there was pretty much no change in how the strike functioned in American labor relations. And you might say that it kind of provided a safety valve for relations between employers and workers. The PATCO strike really changed that. Now, public sector workers, including federal workers, did not have the right to strike in almost all settings as private sector workers had. So when PATCO struck, it was illegal. The breaking of that strike, however, had huge implications, not just for government workers, but for workers in the private sector. Many employers looked at Reagan's success at taking a highly skilled workforce of more than 11,000 people, as you note, and being able to fire them permanently and replace them. And many private sector employers decided that they could try the same thing in strikes in the private sector. And that's what happened in strike after strike in the 1980s, to the point that workers came to the conclusion that strikes no longer worked for them. And we began to see the strike disappear as a part of American labor relations. From that period, from the 60s until 1981, there were roughly 280 significant strikes in the country a year. Just 2 years ago, that number had dropped to 5. So the strike no longer exists for all intents and purposes as a weapon or a tool for unions and workers. And that means essentially that even in cases where employers are tremendously unfair, where they seek wage cuts from workers, even in profitable businesses, workers don't feel that they have the ability to influence negotiations by withholding labor as they once did. I think it's contributed to the growth of inequality that we've seen skyrocketing lately.
Even Chicago teachers' unions apparently took a lesson from that strike.
That's right. Actually, PATCO learned a lot from other public sector workers who were striking with some success in the 1970s, including teachers. However, once PATCO was broken, even teacher strikes, which were teachers were the public sector workers most prone to striking in the 1970s. Teacher strikes also began to become far less common after 1981. Now, nobody likes strikes, I would say. Even union people don't like strikes. But the disappearance of the strike, I think, has some ominous implications because it really represents a kind of dramatic shift in power between workers and their employers, with the power going increasingly toward the employer over the past 20 years. And I do think that that has implications for inequality. Now, to your earlier question, though, about the impact of all of this on our politics, this is one of the interesting things I discovered in looking at the PATCO strike. And that is, I think today many conservatives would be surprised to learn Ronald Reagan's true views on labor and collective bargaining, because Reagan actually went out of his way to try to bargain with the air traffic controllers in 1981 and actually did put on the table an offer to them that was unprecedented compared to even what his predecessor, the Democrat Jimmy Carter, had offered. Reagan believed in bargaining. He thought that he could strike a bargain with the controllers. And in fact, that shouldn't surprise us too much, because as people might know about Reagan's background, he began his public life as not only an actor, but a leader of the Actors Union, Screen Actors Guild. And in fact, he led that union on its first strike against studios in 1952. He understood from his own personal experience why unions were, you know, a positive force for workers. He wasn't trying to break PATCO at the outset. In fact, he was trying to reach an agreement with it. But once the controller struck, that's where Reagan drew the line, because he felt that his whole presidency would be weakened if he negotiated with workers in the midst of an illegal action. He laid down the ultimatum, they defied him, and at that point he never looked back. He broke the union, and by doing that, I think he served to reframe how he'd be remembered by future generations. Most people now look back at Reagan and labor and they remember PATCO and they say Reagan's a union buster. And I think what that did is, within the Republican Party, it made it harder for those moderate Republicans who, like Reagan even in 1981, believed that unions were a positive force, collective bargaining was generally a good thing in American life. It made it harder for those folks to get their views across within their party. And what we've seen, I think, in the past 30 years is an increasing political polarization where the parties are really pulling apart as never before on questions of labor.
You're listening to Joseph A. McCartin. He is a professor of history at Georgetown University and the author of the book we're discussing, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Reagan, on the one hand, we can give him credit for the fact that he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, and he had, as you have indicated, a fairly favorable view toward unions and their role in labor-management relations. But then, after the strike, I mean, it really does look, from reading your book, like he just set out to punish these guys, even at a time when some people in his own White House, perhaps, maybe they weren't in the White House, but they were Republican moderates, were saying, well, it's over now, maybe we have to figure out a way to take them back. And the administration was actually working with agencies like the Merit Systems Protection Board to make sure none of these guys got back. I mean, working on individual cases, is that not right?
That's right. And I don't want to oversell Ronald Reagan as a defender of unions. He came out of a union background. He generally believed in collective bargaining. But this event had a transformative impact on him and his administration, even though he didn't seek this confrontation. Once it happened, it pushed him in a new direction. And basically, as you've just said, what happened was that Reagan determined, once these folks defied him, that he would not compromise at all. Now, in the early days of the PATCO strike, public support was running overwhelmingly behind the president and drawing the line with air traffic controllers, even firing them. But what's most interesting to me is, about 3 months into the strike, when it was clear that the administration had prevailed, the air traffic system was still working, PATCO was broken, that the public began to favor mercy, finding a way to rehire at least most of the strikers to save the public the tremendous amount of money it would take to retrain an entire workforce, to get the airlines back up running a full schedule again. But even when public opinion shifted, and some prominent Republicans like Jack Kemp, the congressman from upstate New York, or William Safire, the conservative Republican columnist in those days for the New York Times, even when they prevailed on Reagan and said, Mr. President, why don't you just declare victory and hire back some of these folks, that the president did not listen to those pleas. And in fact, as you point out, and as I write in the book, the administration really came down hard to make sure that nobody who had been fired for defying this ban was able to successfully appeal their firing and get reinstated. They really pushed it to the limit. And I think in many ways, it was that decision, several months into the strike, that was even more important in shaping history since then, more important than the initial ultimatum. It was the president's decision to take no one back, And I think it was a profoundly game-changing decision. It shocked people in the labor relations community because public sector strikes had happened before that on the municipal level around the country. In many cases, they'd been illegal. Sometimes the unions were fined. Sometimes their leaders were even jailed. But usually afterward, accommodations were made. Things were worked out. That didn't happen in this case, and that had huge implications.
Again, for our listeners who may have come in the middle of the interview, when we refer to PATCO, we're talking about the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, the union that was broken in 1981. You mentioned the ghost of PATCO in the book, or perhaps it's one of the articles I read surrounding the book's release. The 1981 strike did have repercussions all the way down to Governor Scott Walker's challenging the teachers' unions in Wisconsin last year. Help us understand that.
That's right. As most of your listeners are probably aware, just about a year ago now, then newly elected governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, decided to basically attempt to strip most public sector workers in Wisconsin of most of their bargaining rights. As he himself later described it, just before he went to the legislature with this plan, he called his staff together, took out a portrait of Ronald Reagan, reminded his staff of the confrontation between Reagan and the air traffic controllers, said, folks, Reagan had this confrontation 30 years ago and it changed history, and now is our time to change history. We've got to take on this labor movement in Wisconsin and take these rights away from it. And Walker was able, after a long struggle that was much in the news, to be victorious in getting his bill through. There's still a fight going on in the state because right now the labor movement is trying to lead a recall effort to remove him from office. But that event, I think, shows how much the PATCO strike continues to resonate and how it became a kind of rallying cry for those who want to take on organized labor and weaken it. And again, I think the irony of this is that Ronald Reagan never sought to do what Scott Walker has attempted to do and tried to accomplish in Wisconsin. That is, Reagan never challenged the air traffic controllers' right to bargain, only their right to strike illegally. But now, 30 years later, PATCO and the ghost of PATCO, you might say, exists mainly as a rallying point for those who want to go further than Reagan himself had ever gone.
Today we're talking with Joseph A. McCartin. He's the author of Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. You mentioned earlier two of the leaders of the PATCO strike, Mike Rock and Jack Maher, and in your acknowledgments, you point out that you really got to know these guys. They both have passed on fairly recently. You have interviewed their families. It was a very touching part of the book for me that you're reflecting on the many years you worked with them and so many others in making this book come together. And as I learned more about them, I just couldn't help but question what led them and the other leaders to this confrontation where they would take it to the wall and why they wouldn't see this coming. And what is it about their union solidarity that blinded them to what could have been expected to be Reagan's reaction, and maybe not. But I wonder if you could just help us get to know these guys a little better and what role they played in just making some bad decisions.
That was really the question that got me into this project. I could not understand how more than 11,000 people, most of them military veterans like Jack Maher and Mike Rock, most of them who enlisted in the military, most of them who did not define themselves as radicals by any means, engaged in an all-out confrontation with the federal government. What would lead these seemingly normal suburban dwelling working people
right
into that kind of a position? So that's what I wanted to try to figure out. And basically what I learned in interviews, not only with Maher Rock and many other controllers, but with people in five presidential administrations, with people from the FAA and the management side and from others, is that a kind of toxic environment had developed at the FAA in terms of the relations between its workforce and its management. And that toxic relationship, I think, was never completely solved, and it contributed to a growing disaffection among the workers. And when you add to it the, you know, I think, bad management style of the FAA, when you add to that the fact that controllers began pouring out of the Vietnam-era military in the late 60s and early 70s and joining the FAA, and it was those Vietnam-era controllers, the younger ones than Maher and Rock, who both joined the FAA back in 1959, these younger folks had been disillusioned by their Vietnam experience. They had already experienced a government that they felt wasn't quite honest with them. And they already felt that once they returned from Vietnam, they were neglected. And they felt in their work at the FAA, they were neglected. And there was a disaffection that existed and that flourished in the FAA. And sadly, the leadership was lacking that was able to overcome that. And I think that disaffection, combined with the unique nature of air traffic control work, where there was an enormous sense of group mentality and solidarity among air traffic controllers. They were unique people. You have to be a special kind of person to do that job. And when you learn that job, you learn it in teams, and you're trained by senior controllers, and you develop tight, tight bonds. And the sense of group feeling among them was enormously powerful. When you understand that that group feeling was also one of great disaffection with their employers, then you can start to understand their thinking of what led them into this conflict. In some ways, they never even thought about what will happen. Will we be fired? Because for them, the important point was, we want this government to finally listen to us. We've been complaining about some of these things for 20 years, and we've gotten nowhere. And by golly, if it takes shutting down this system to force them to listen, that's what we're going to do. And that ultimately resulted in this tragedy.
So, Joe, we're almost to the top of the hour, but I must ask you if you could just describe briefly the air traffic control system today and its relationship to the FAA. How are things different today?
Things have improved in some important ways. Ironically, right after PATCO was broken, within 6 years, another union was established of air traffic controllers. It's called the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. And it was formed by many of the replacement workers who were hired. And that, by the way, I think testifies to the fact that there really was a feeling among controllers that there was a need for a union at the FAA. NATCA has worked out a more amicable relationship with the FAA, but there are still problems in the system. And I think in many ways the system still struggles with some of the after effects of the strike. For example, in the past 5 years, there's been an enormous wave of retirements of the controllers who were hired after the strike and are leaving the system en masse and forcing the system to try to retrain a lot of young controllers very quickly. It's definitely a safer system. It's a better system. It's a more amicable system of labor relations, but it's still not without problems.
Well, Joe, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much for coming onto the show. And I must say, if I had to sum up what I liked most about your book, it's such a balanced treatment of all of the nuances that go into this incident in American history that's had such an incredible impact. Thank you so much for writing it, and thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Joseph A. McCartin, the author of Collision Course.
Thank you, Bob.
Next week, Donovan Hone, author of Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea, and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Matt Penny. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.